This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University. And today I'm joined by Sasha Eisenberg, who is the author of The Lie Detectors, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Sasha is also the author of other books, including The Victory Lab. He's also been a correspondent for a number of newspapers, including the New York and the New York Times Magazine, Bloomsburg Weekly. But he's also a professor at UCLA in the Department of Political Science. Sasha, welcome to The Politics Guys.
Thank you, politics guy. It's great to be here.
I appreciate it. You're just getting one today. It's true. We don't have everybody when we do our interviews. And I'll tell you, I always love doing the interviews when we get other political scientists. We don't always get those. So it's a lot of fun having you here.
I should say I teach in a political science department. I am the only non-academic, non-social scientist who at the moment teaches in the UCLA political science department.
So, oh, okay. Well, see, I'm learning something.
They brought me in as something of a practitioner, and I try to give students, undergraduates, some useful knowledge about how to read and think about campaigns and elections, but I am not in any way trained as a political scientist.
You know, it is, I like that you leaned with that, because one of the things I had noted about your book, and I don't mean this as an insult, but I meant it as a good way, was it didn't read like a poli-sci tome at all.
Yes. Well, good, I guess. Yeah. You know, my background is as a journalist. And as you mentioned, I've written for newspapers and magazines and been an editor and done a whole lot of things. And I've spent a fair bit of time around political scientists, and I think I have some familiarity with both methodology and some of the important questions and ways that people think about campaigns and elections. But fundamentally, I think I'm doing something a little different. And you know, this book grew out of one, The Victory Lab, that was very much about how innovations in social science research, especially the use of randomized control trials, were shaping the way that people inside campaigns worked. And this is sort of a continuation of my reporting on how people in campaigns are thinking about some of the new challenges that they have in this information environment.
Yeah, and I'll be honest. When I first was going through the book, and I came to you had this whole cast characters early on, you know, both individuals and the organizations that you're going to go through. And I'm not going to lie, I kind of glossed over that, and I thought, oh well, I'm gonna be able to keep this straight. That's not a big deal. And then when I got done with my first read, I was going back and really trying to connect the dots on some of those things, because there are so many moving actors in your book. And, you know, as I was looking at it and thinking about it, rereading it, what I saw was really that you were kind of maybe looking at, in this tome, kind of that second part, as you're referring to, is maybe some of the more hidden players who are trying at that campaign level to either identify or combat what they think of as being disinformation. But you also seem to be challenging the notion of disinformation as propagated by the American left, at least at that campaign level. So, Sasha, could you start by just kind of outlining for listeners kind of that central narrative of your book, and maybe, if you can, a thumbnail sketch of some of those really important players?
Yeah, so it's fundamentally a story of how the primarily American left, but I do have a chapter that's set in Brazil, post 2016 has grappled with this new information environment, and the core way that the people who are doing it define it as it around the idea of misinformation or disinformation. What sort of becomes clear is that, you know, and where I felt my point of entry to this was feeling a couple of years ago like I had read plenty of things about disinformation as a sort of democracy level challenge, as a societal challenge, about a geopolitical about it as a geopolitical tool. I'd read a lot about what the social media platforms could or should be doing, about possibly what government regulation could do. But the one thing that was missing, that to me as a political journalist who's written a lot about campaigns and elections, was what do campaigners do in this newly asymmetric media environment where their opposition isn't necessarily their opponent. Mm-hmm. It is not necessarily another candidate or party or labor union or super PAC, but it's not a what I would sort of say is a legitimate political communicator who's constrained by campaign finance rules and the tax code and various laws that require some disclosure and transparency about how they're raising money and spending it. Might not even be constrained by the laws of the United States. Certainly isn't necessarily constrained by some of the norms and professional consequences that I think have kept political actors from like egregiously, recklessly lying without fear of consequences. And so how do you run a campaign when you're up against a foreign intelligence service or somebody in their basement who's anonymous online, or a sort of, you know, an online mob that isn't really accountable as a political act or any of these things? And so that's sort of that's the thing that sets it up, is this new dynamic that at least American political campaigners became aware of, cognizant of, as they reckoned with Donald Trump's victory in 2016. And it is largely an account of the last, whatever that is, 7 years. And these different strands, as you point out, Trey, of people sort of thinking about how you respond to it. So I tell a story of some efforts that were funded by Reid Hoffman, the LinkedIn co-founder, who's become one of the biggest donors on the American left, that end up seeding false flag operations, disinformation operations during the 2017 Alabama Senate special election, designed to damage Roy Moore, the Republican nominee. I write about an effort by a nonprofit and a super PAC called We Defend Truth, whose sort of animating idea is, let's push back against conspiracy theories by basically adopting their sensibility and aesthetics, use humor and memes and GIFs and kind of the coarse patois of the internet, instead of responding with you know, fact checks or traditional political messaging. And I write about how, you know, organizations like the Democratic National Committee and Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee have tried to sort of institutionalize tracking and monitoring so that their candidates can have a sort of a better read on what's moving online and make smarter decisions about how and when to respond to it. And the main character that sort of, you know, holds the reader's hand that you follow through most of this book is this woman named Jory Craig, who she's November 2016, she's 25 years old. She's from Illinois, a political operative who had never worked on an American political campaign. She had been a model UN nerd in high school and ended up working for this firm called Greenberg Quinlan Rosner that sort of, due to a quirk of history, becomes the Democratic consulting firm in Washington that does the most overseas work. The founding partner, Stan Greenberg, was Bill Clinton's pollster, and then he goes to work for Nelson Mandela and Tony Blair. And so the firm ends up creating the sideline, doing campaigns all over the world. And right out of college, Jory Craig gets a job there, and she's first sent as a digital consultant to Moldova, where she's advising a party leader how to get on Facebook. And and then she's sent to Gabon and the Philippines and Panama and the Bahamas. And so when 2016 rolls around, she's, she's following it as an American, but from abroad, not involved in any way. But after the 2016 election, all the sort of top people in the Democratic political ecosystem, people who've been involved in campaigns sometimes for decades, start realizing there's a whole sort of vocabulary that they've never encountered before. And they're asking around, you know, who should we be talking to understand what a bot farm is, what a troll army is, what a hack and dump operation is. And they realize that nobody who's worked in American campaigns has encountered any of this either. But the one person that they all end up winding back to is Jori Craig, because a lot of what seemed novel in the United States in 2016, foreign interference, sort of unaccountable spending, the rise of partisan and ideologically motivated media organizations, all of this might have struck us as novel, but was a sort of core part of the political process all around the world. And she'd been dealing with candidates and parties who'd been having to make calculations about how you engage with this for years, and brought a sort of sense of proportion to it. And so she's sort of the main character of the book and winds through.
Well, that was a key element that I was curious for you to speak into a little bit more, and you'd brought that up. I mean, that was even going to be my second question was, you know, the idea in the United States, I think that there was this kind of idea, at least popularly inside of these campaigns, that it's unique, at least in terms of, like you're noting, kind of some of these new strategies in disinformation. But historically speaking, it's only unique in the U.S., sort of, right?
I mean,
yeah, even kind of
right.
goes
and
back
not,
a little
not wildly
earlier.
Than... ahistorical, right? So, like, let's, you know, in the 19th century, just about all of our media was in some form partisan or ideologically motivated. That was not a novelty. It's more a quirk of our history that for most of the 20th century, the sort of economics and cultural pressures around media
kind of keep that from happening.
Yeah, pushed our TV networks, our big radio presence, at least until the end of the repeal of fairness doctrine in the 80s. Newspapers aspiring to some form of sort of public neutrality. And you know, that's anomalous among our peer countries. I mean, really, I think I would say, you know, Canada and maybe Japan are the only one of our economic sort of peer countries that we would say followed that path. And you know, every country in Western Europe, for example, it's just taken for granted that the newspapers have picked a side and make decisions about what goes on the front page every day, about what helps their side or not. And that readers pick their media outlets based on ideological affinity above anything else. And so if you'd only done politics in the United States, waking up in 2016 and going, oh my God, like people are getting their news from the Daily Wire or they're getting their news from MSNBC. And they, you know, those news organizations are making editorial decisions based on what's better for their side. Yeah, that might strike you as news, but it wasn't if you'd, you know, done politics anywhere else, for example.
And so then this ends up coming to the United States. And this seems to be, at least in your narrative of it, is kind of catches the left a little bit flat-footed. And you even say, look, I had to follow the left because it's the left in the United States that's really trying to combat, again, whether you want to call it disinformation or misinformation, or, and again, you problematize that, especially when you get to Brazil. Why do you think that this was so difficult for left leaning campaign groups and brokers to really deal with?
Yeah, so I think it fundamentally was difficult for, it has been difficult for political communicators to deal with broadly. I think the left, because of the trauma of Trump's victory, right? So after November 2016, I think everybody in the world, to exaggerate only slightly, is shocked by Trump's victory. And among folks on the American left, the quest to understand what happens leads in all sorts of places, right? So some people are focusing on Midwestern industrial states where Clinton underperformed. Some people are focusing on demographic groups where you know, she didn't do as well as Obama did. Some people are focusing on her performance as a candidate, right? The whole policy shifts in the, within the party coalition. But one line of inquiry focuses on all these things that happened on the internet over the course of the 2016 campaign that either were not sort of recognized, appreciated, or at the moment, or understood as part of a broader phenomenon. And that ends up being the involvement of Russian intelligence services, as the Mueller report later described, becoming active in trying to communicate with American voters via Facebook. There was a story, a fascinating story that came out immediately after the election in November 2016 about Macedonian teenagers who were trying to make money off of basically Google ad clicks, and had realized that the thing that would get Americans to most readily click on their content was provocative and generally untrue content about American politics. Mm-hmm. And so they started making these websites. And so all of these things sort of happened in isolation. They didn't get a lot of attention because I think that our political media, and I say this as a willing participant, are very bad at thinking about decentralized political actors of any kind, and whether they're activists or Macedonian teens. And so nobody really, I think, stitched this together until you had Democrats who are sort of autopsying Hillary Clinton's defeat. And all of a sudden it becomes, wait, all this stuff is happening online. And fundamentally the shift, I think, is from the decentralized media environment in which generations of political professionals have been trained to think about political communication. You know, a world where three TV networks and some big city regional newspapers and, you know, RIP news weeklies, but still, like, where you could control access to the large part of information flow that American voters receive if you could manage media coverage in those places. And what we think of as a sort of, you know, the canonical archetypes of the great, you know, modern American political strategists, you know, Lee Atwater, Karl Rove, David Axelrod, whoever, they were all people, James Carville. But part of the story we told was that they were really good at managing appearances through mass media. Yeah. And I think the reckoning after 2016 was that's a farce. You know, mass media is far less influential. And there are all sorts of other sources of information, particularly online, that are reaching voters, and very few political communicators in the United States had ever thought of that as anything other than a sideshow.
Yeah, just kind of noise. As a matter of fact, I love that, because you in the book even say, look, one of the problems, one of the reasons the left is focusing on misinformation and disinformation isn't just primarily because of its effect, although there is undoubtedly an effect, but because they view that as being kind of, and you're putting it, that decentralized, their own power is waning. In your words, you say it's the end of the quote modernist era, end quote, where operatives can kind of see all the chess moves, but misinformation arises from a decentralized network where you can't have that grand chess strategist sitting there. So to what extent is the misinformation, disinformation battle on the left about disinformation and misinformation, and what extent is it kind of, again, you don't use this term, but kind of maybe this radical transformation of what it means to try to be that chess player, and maybe the end of that era, people just kind of flailing at that?
Yeah, this is where I think my focus on the people inside campaigns is different than, let me make a distinction, I guess, between broadly. I think there are a lot of folks on the left who are thinking about policy, who are thinking about what matters for democracy, who are thinking about how the tech companies deal with content moderation. And I think for them, the truth or falsity of content online is a very important distinction.
Key, yeah.
Yeah, and so, if you're talking about increasing liability for social tech companies for what they publish online, one of the crucial ways in which our libel law distinguishes between content is was it knowingly false when you published it, and what level of intentionality did you bring to that? So that's a meaningful distinction if you're talking about the law. Some of the actual the policies that Facebook or Instagram whatever have now impersonation and certain types of false representation are a violation of the policies. I think a lot of academic researchers are really focused on the idea of inaccurate facts moving and people developing false knowledge about public affairs. Mm-hmm. All that said, I think for the people I'm writing about inside campaigns, and these are folks on candidate campaigns, including like the Biden reelect now, people at the party committees, consultants who are being hired by those groups. Ultimately, what became clear to me over a year and a half of reporting in this world is they use the word disinformation a lot. For them, the meaningful distinction is not between truth and falsity. Fundamentally, they're sort of the tactical responses that they are developing and implementing are pretty much the same, whether an attack is coming at you that is completely false, somewhat false, generally true, entirely true. I think for them, the real question is this coming from, is this just moving sort of virally with online word of mouth in a way that makes it much more difficult to measure its reach by traditional heuristics? And so, mm-hmm. I think if you go back to, let's say, 1995, I mentioned James Carville earlier, just to take a sort of moment, our last pre-digital moment, right? If you're in the 1996 campaign, you sort of have intuited over years of being in politics some rules of thumb about the reach of your opponent's attack. So if something is on, page one of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, then we need to really, push back at this. But if it's on page 19 of the Decatur newspaper, maybe we sit back and we wait a little bit and see if it's reaching, if it's breaking through. Or if this talk radio host is really, obsessed with this issue, we don't have to be that concerned. But if this other talk radio host, they reach a different audience and that could really get the attention of other news organizations. And this was just sort of baked into how communications operatives thought about the impact of negative coverage, whether it was true or false, baseless, whatever. That doesn't translate online when you're dealing with, certainly social media. And so a lot of, I think, what they're thinking about is not, is it true or false, but is how do we identify what is actually an electoral threat to us online, and how do we respond to it without making the problem worse in ways that are unique to some forms of misleading attacks. But fundamentally, they know that their job is not to police accuracy on the internet. And one way that makes it clear is you talk to the people who are at the Democratic National Committee or something and who work on counter disinformation. They spend all day watching online to see if people are, saying bad stuff about Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. They do not think it's their problem if people are saying inaccurate stuff about Trump. Donald Trump. Yeah. Right.
Well, when you talk about that, as I read, I often as a researcher have kind of thought about this as the pre and post Dean Scream era, right? Yeah. That idea of, well, this isn't going to have any traction. It's kind of not going to move forward. And of course, this is a much earlier picture, but the countless video memes of the Dean Scream undoubtedly harm him in ways that most, I think, in a different era would have thought, oh, well, as you're kind of saying, that the rule of thumb is going to be, well, that's going to die down. That's only going to have legs for 2 seconds and it's not forward. But I like how you come back there and you talk about the fact, look, from the left, it's not really about the truth content. And one of the things that I noticed was the number of individuals in the book who talked about, look, our goal is to run a, quote, Trump-style campaign. And what one analyst called this was aggressive and eye-popping digitally. And so is that part of this, maybe actual misinformation or maybe so-called misinformation campaign is really more to, can we get the Democrats to emulate the Trump model? Is that kind of what's happening here?
Yeah,
in some ways?
I think different people see different aspects of Trump's online campaigning as worth learning from. So I would sort of note, so the example you gave, I think is from that group, We Defend Truth.
And yes, yes, it is. Yes.
Their idea is basically the reason that right-wing messaging, and particularly they're worried about certain conspiracy theories. They've done work against coronavirus-related disinformation, against post 2020 election, you know, denial, skepticism of the legitimacy of Biden's victory. Their view fundamentally is that a lot of what the right intuitively got about online communication is they're entertaining. And it's true, conspiracy theories like are more entertaining often than the truth. That's part of the reason that they're, I was 14 when I went into my first like JFK assassination rabbit hole. And yeah, the conspiracy theory stuff was like far more entertaining to me as a teenager than the Warren Commission report was, right?
Yeah, it was similar for in my area. It was, did Kurt Cobain actually kill himself?
Yes. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so part of it is you. So part of what they're saying is like, yes, one, we need to figure out how to be entertaining. Often the kind of response to lies online takes on a sort of scolding tone. Here's the fact check, you know, eat your vegetables, do your homework, you know, do your research feels like, you know, that doesn't sound fun. So I think some of it is that, and in this group's particular case, it is like, there's a language that works online and it's pop culture, you know. So this group goes out and hires. They
find Bo Elliott, right? Hate My Pee-Pee. So tell us about him, because I mean, he becomes this really, this guy who on it's a GIF or a GIF sharing site. He ends up becoming a central player because of just how funny his memes are, right?
Right. So the guy from this group, David Goldstein, who's been a pollster and a Democratic political operative, and starts to focus on this question in 2017. He really says, like, you know, we are not going to be able to get in front of people online unless we are first entertaining. That's the barrier to entry, and then we have to be persuasive and convincing. But unless we get past the over the entertaining hurdle, we can't reach people online. Mm-hmm. And so basically, he's thinking like, what's entertaining online? And this the whole culture of GIFs and memes, content that people willingly share because they enjoy sharing stuff that amuses them. And so he seeks out, he'd been a sort of casual fan of GIFs and memes, and goes and contacts this guy who has had some of the highest rated content ever on Reddit and on Imgur and the sites where people were, the communities have been built around this. And he contacts this guy whose screen name is I Hate My Pee-Pee.
I loved everything about that.
Which gives you a sense of the level at which some of his humor is operating.
Well, it's a joke from his kiddo, which I also just thought was funny. Yeah.
And Goldstein sends this guy a DM, and he has no idea what his politics are, because most of what he's doing is making, you know, jokes about, you know, the 40-year-old virgin or something, right? Taking random video clips and putting text under them. And
you answered me, and again, just a dumb question. He's apparently the first guy who does the Avengers meme, you know, and who hasn't seen that one?
and so Goldstein says, like, I want to go find the people who are most successful at being entertained online. He contacts this guy. His name's Bo Elliott. And it turns out that he has lefty politics. And he says, I'd love to do this. And We Defend Truth gives him basically polling reports and focus group reports about how to persuade a group of primarily people who are believing Trump's lies about the 2020 election, a group that they identify through public opinion research. They call them believers by default. They sort of push aside a subset of people who believe the election conspiracies, who they think are unpersuadable. These are actually people who are really bought into a kind of MAGA worldview. But there's a slice of people who have accepted Trump's lies about the 2020 election, who are not strong believers in that there was a conspiracy to rig the election. They are people who are like naturally skeptical of institutions, political speech. They are kind of like conspiracy curious. They defaulted to accepting sort of the prevailing conspiracy theory of the day. But there, this opinion research that We Defend Truth Commission suggests that they can actually be convinced that, you know, that the results were legitimate and Biden did win in November 2020. And this becomes a target audience for Elliott's gifs and memes that they hire him to do. And the idea is, you know, these are people who are not very, because they are united in a certain type of skepticism and resistance to what they think of as establishment communication, it's almost counterproductive to send them a Washington Post fact check of yeah. There were 73 court cases, because they're inclined not to believe that. It doesn't work if you get them a Secretary of State saying on the record our results were accurately tabulated. But the research suggested that if you can start a conversation with these people, if you give them stuff that is entertaining and does not look like political communication. And on the internet, what does that look like? It looks like taking a Sacha Baron Cohen scene from The Dictator and running a bunch of text under it that sort of plays at the patriotism of these viewers by suggesting that, you know, the rest of the world is going to see us as a banana republic if we don't abide by our election results. And so that's one view of what Trump does well online. I would say the other sort of big prevailing.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Idea of what Democrats can learn from Trump is that Trump accidentally basically became a pioneer in something that people on the left have been calling digital organizing for a while now, a term that has become so overused as to be meaningless most of the time. but what I think at its core it means is relinquishing some as a candidate or a party, relinquishing some control to entrust your supporters to develop and maintain relationships online so that they can communicate on your behalf. And the core of this is a recognition that campaigns have been too transactional in how they approach the internet, going back to, you know, roughly 2000, like the dawn of campaigns getting online. Largely what campaigns did was they looked to the internet and they said, hey, this is a way to get to take things we are already doing and make them faster and cheaper to reach voters or our supporters. And so what did campaigns do? They created lists to ask for money. They sometimes asked those lists to volunteer and created ways that people can make phone calls or print out walk sheets from home without having to go into a field office and pick up a clipboard. Occasionally they said, hey, you know, here's our YouTube video, share it with your friends. But they never said, go talk to people in online communities about the candidate. And that's because they never did that offline. It would be like the biggest political malpractice if you were a field organizer and a bunch of people showed up in your office one Tuesday evening when you bought pizza and you told your most enthusiastic volunteers, hey, just walk around the neighborhood and talk to people about abortion. Like, you would never do that. Why? Because, like, you've spent lots of money, presumably, on your campaign doing issue research, policy research, opposition research, messaging research to determine how exactly you speak about abortion, where, when, to whom. And you want to control that through the candidate's mouth, through ads, through direct mail. And Trump, just by his instinct and intuition, and so I think probably short attention span, had a very different approach to the internet, which is he saw stuff online that amused him and he retweeted it or shared it. And he sent a signal to his supporters that their voice online mattered, that he wanted them to communicate, often through GIFs and memes and such. And that has And what he ended up doing, I think it's one reason that MAGA has become such a durable, meaningful online community for the people who are a part of it. I mean, far more, you know, I think one way to look at it.
You don't mention this, but do you think that's why? So, for example, we had talked on the show about this at the time, and there was a little bit of a split between the guys on the left and the guys on the right. But you recall the famous "I am inevitable" meme that came from Trump, right, and putting him into the place of Thanos in Infinity Wars, and a lot on the left thought, "Oh, well, this is terrible because, you know, you're making the wrong message." But it connected to people. Is that kind of what you're getting at here when you say that Trump kind of intuitively had that?
Yes, and what I think, you know, a traditional campaign mindset would be, "Hey, we've done all this research, and part of what flows from that is we know what we want to be talking about every day. We have our message of the day. We have, you know, so and Trump often by retweeting something." Did something that was sort of at odds with what his campaign advisors, it was a distraction. Mm-hmm. But part of the upside of that distraction is, especially when you're sharing your supporters' homemade content, is you're empowering them. You're telling them, you know, you're bringing them into the campaign in a way Barack Obama never did. You know, Barack Obama gave great speeches and at times had great ads and had some of the finest members of the Black Eyed Peas making music videos for him.
That's right.
But there was never a signal to, like, you know, your random person at home that Barack Obama values your voice about why to support him over Mitt Romney. Like, you know, Donald Trump sent a signal to his supporters all the time. Hey, what you have to say about Hillary Clinton matters. I'm going to share it with my audience. And what does that do? That it motivates them to create more content organically, some of which is at odds or in tension with the campaign's preferred messaging. But you do, empower your supporters to basically do DIY messaging. And what you've done, we're now, you know, 8 or 9 years into this, you create a community that in large part online is defined by their desire to outdo themselves creating content in part to get the attention of Trump and his circle. And so, you know, they've created organic content farms by because Trump has signaled that it's personally meaningful to him. And the trade-off is, yeah, sometimes it's a distraction from what they want to accomplish. But in the long term, what they've done is they've really created a community that offers rewards to people who are a part of it, as opposed to many political campaigns, which basically ask voters for things, for money, for volunteer shifts, and offer not a whole lot beyond, you know, pizza and, you know, and a free lawn sign in return. Yeah. Not as many karmic rewards, right?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about that then a little bit, because this is an area, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but the age-old debate between practitioners and political scientists come out, and that is, if it seems most the assumption here, and you were laying it out, was if we can be engaging first, then that will open the possibility for us to be persuasive to particular subsets of groups. But of course, on the social side of things, that's a long-standing question, right? How persuasive even are campaigns, right? There is a lot of scientific literature that says that that is just not effective. Instead, it's really more about framing and priming and these other kinds of effects. But at least from the groups that you were looking at, they really were shooting for persuasion. But again, in a previous era, our answer was, it doesn't really persuade as effectively. Is that something else different about this era, or is that just, do you think, a bias of campaign managers thinking that they can persuade? How does that work here?
Yeah, so I think there is a longstanding bias of campaign communicators, at least to the extent they're aware of the academic literature on opinion formation to minimize it. That said, I would make a few notes. Like one. Yes, you know, we're in an environment where probably between 8 and 12% of the electorate is persuadable in the presidential race and statewide races, partisan statewide races. And it is very hard to get people to shift votes in a general election format with any type of communication. And I don't think that we should, I think there has been to some extent a bit of a, you know, what I think of as like the magical disinformation fallacy that that people on, you know, particularly on the left have subscribed to since 2016, which is the same people who will say, yeah, you know, political ads don't do anything. Direct mail. Ah, my mailbox got filled up with direct mail. What a waste. whose opinion is going to be changed by that? And then it's like, oh, my God, the Russians spent $100,000 on Facebook ads. That must have swung the election. And it's like,
yeah.
$16 billion or something is going to be spent this election cycle. Let's not assume that disinformation or communication from a foreign government has some magical ability to change opinions that traditional political communication can't. If you're skeptical of one, you should be skeptical of the other. That said, some of the opinion stuff is not focused on the We Defend Truth stuff. They were most of their work has been nonpartisan, focus on changing opinions about, for example, the legitimacy of the 2020 election results. That is I think a lot of our thinking on persuasion is probably shaped by candidate choice and partisan races. That you can imagine is an area where there is less of a binary, far fewer. At least maybe this is changing, but far fewer natural partisan cues to people that shuffle them immediately into one camp or the other. And so I think that you know, it's possible that debunking novel conspiracy theories does not have the same challenges of persuasion that partisan electoral contests do. And the other thing I would say is like I have a chapter that's about the Biden campaign in 2020 and a big research project they did to try to minimize the impact of sort of negative viral narratives. They call it disinformation, but some of them weren't things that are entirely false. And in their view, yeah, they were very much focused only on disinformation narratives that would shift views of the, you know, we'll say 10% of the electorate that was persuadable in 2020. But this was an enterprise that was spending $1 billion, most of which to affect the opinions of 10% of voters in seven states. And so it was not, the alternative was like, let's not try to persuade them. It was, do we think about these online viral narratives as a different persuasion challenge than what we're trying to deal with our television ads, for example, or what we're doing with our direct mail, or what we're doing with our free media. And so, I think we're still sort of stuck in the novelty phase of all this. And I think one area where people lose sight of reality is to assume that the normal rules of persuasion don't apply if it's the internet or if it's foreign communicators or if it's, you know, capital D disinformation. And like, no, that seems like a silly way to think about this.
Probably in part because that is such, it feels so new, and we always have that kind of gravitation to the thing that's new to having to be relevant. But you then spend a chapter, and you mentioned this early in the interview, talking about the book, you talked about your book on Brazil, and I was happy about that because the Brazilian chapter, and maybe I'm wrong, but it felt to me like that you had, that was kind of a cautionary tale. And what you were kind of saying was, look, you can, you know, so basically in Brazil, there is an institutionalized fight against quote unquote fake news in this particular instance, as kind of a campaign strategy for left wing candidates who had gained control of some of the judiciary aspects of Brazil. And you kind of seemed, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like you were cautioning the left a little bit and saying, careful, because you don't want to take the fight against quote unquote misinformation too far, because it can itself become a kind of a deadly thing if it's institutionalized. Am I reading that right? Is that why that Brazil chapter is there? And walk us through that, because I saw that as being a useful chapter, I won't lie.
Yeah, so you know what I wanted to do was, one, show how political actors respond to having this powerful regulatory force, this supreme judicial electoral tribunal that can order stuff taken down on Facebook within the hour and fine the company large amounts of money if it doesn't. The Chief Justice has had people jailed for posts that he basically say or is untrue without any thing that we would think of as due process or potential for quick adjudication. And it's pretty scary from an American perspective. And Brazil has a unique history here. It has a different constitution. There is no absolute guarantee of free speech in Brazil. There are fears that are, I think, particular to the experience of dictatorship there that they create concerns about propaganda and that are where there's a totally different balancing, I think, of individual freedoms versus kind of collective concerns in Brazilian constitutional law and in part aspects of political culture. But you look at this and one, yes, so it is. On one hand, if you said for people who wish that there would be a stronger role for government to play policing this, I think it is here it is. And it actually works. And it works so much that it is very hard to get people on the Brazilian left or broad center, basically the broad anti-Bolsonarista parts of Brazilian politics and civil society, including a lot of constitutional law professors, who will not on the record go that far criticizing this court because they've been very happy with the outcomes. And the outcomes are that it did more than anybody else, including Lula's own campaign, to keep Bolsonaro from winning another term and to punish the people who hold accountable the people who organized the attack on government buildings in Brazilia in January of 23. So they're happy with the results, but very few of them actually can defend the process behind it. And, the thing I wanted to sort of look at in Brazil was still from the context of what does that mean for campaigns? Okay, well, now you're in an environment where you actually do have a government agency that will do a lot of the work of sort of, what you hope will be enforcing content moderation decisions on companies. What it's turned into is that campaigns are now using what they call judicialization, but using the legal process that enables as a way of doing the same type of tactical communications work that I described folks in the U.S. doing without the legal structure. So right. Now, instead of trying to get a fact check put up by a news organization so that you can push people there, you file a lawsuit in court so that you can now get the news organizations to write about the fact that this is being challenged in court. And to some degree, you end up with some version, what the note that chapter sort of ends on is yes, this is a very different legal environment. There's a lot about it that I think would not be appealing to Americans, but actually you get into the campaigns and it looks kind of similar hour to hour, day to day, how they're approaching this.
Well, and one other thing in Brazil, as we kind of finish up a little bit here, is you begin to look a little bit more closely at kind of the uneasy relationship between state actors and private partners of media platforms like WhatsApp and Facebook. And this also seems to be a little bit of a cautionary tale for the U.S. I mean, you don't mention the open case in the U.S., where the White House is working closely with social media companies to delete certain kinds of information, but you certainly walk up to that line and suggest that this might not be the best strategy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are ways in which it's clearly counterproductive. There are legal actions that have taken place in Brasilia that drive more attention to things online. And I'm not a policymaker, but I think that Americans across the political spectrum are concerned about having anybody who's policing, what can be spoken in places. And I think that is, I don't think many Americans would want the federal government being an arbiter of what's true or false. I also think that a lot of people probably have reservations about 40 people sitting in a conference room in Menlo Park at the Facebook offices deciding what's true or false online. That said, I also am like, you know, I think it is hard if you care about the nature of democracy in the United States not to see the persistence, especially of some totalizing conspiracy theories, and the absence of sort of other trusted institutions that can serve as a counterweight to them is like a big ongoing problem, not just about whether your preferred candidate wins or loses an election or is harmed by, you know, a deep fake video, although like that's a reasonable concern, I think. I think the bigger thing is if, you know, governing in this moment, creating any sort of consensus, even about underlying facts about how our government functions, about policies, that becomes really difficult. And it is very difficult to imagine a healthy political system that survives without any shared understanding of just some basic facts. And so, you know, I came away from this being like, I would say probably being more concerned about the challenge to democracy, less concerned that any one high profile campaign is going to be derailed by a particular instance of disinformation. I think this is where, you know, the challenge of persuading people is really tough. I think that there are a lot of media coverage is laced through with the idea of like, well, this deepfake video derailed Joe Biden's campaign or whatever. Like, I think that's really unlikely. I'd be very concerned about down ballot races where voters have less information. There may not be partisan cues. There are fewer news organizations that are covering them. The campaigns are less equipped to deal with this stuff in real time. That's where I think the real worry should be for citizens. And I think all of this is set against the backdrop that a lot of the institutions that a generation ago helped shape some shared understanding of how the world worked. And that was, you know, media institutions, that was credibility of academic institutions, scientific expertise, the courts, the FBI, the, you know, public health establishment, religious institutions. There were a lot of institutions in American life that helped people understand what was real and what was fake in the world. And almost all of them are weaker in their cultural standing now than they were when either of us was born. And I think that is a big problem for the country going forward. And there are no obvious, easy solutions that don't have really bad trade-offs attached to them. Until we get to the point where some of those institutions are, you know, reestablish themselves as credible in the eyes of citizens.
Well, Sasha, it has been wonderful chatting with you and to get a chance to read your book, The Lie Detective Test. Thanks for being here on The Politics Guys.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Again, it's Sasha Eisenberg is who we have on the show today, and his book is The Lie Detectives in Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age, and it is available right now. That ends this interview episode of The Politics Guys. And so I'm going to end by saying, if you're not already a supporter of The Politics Guys, if you want to have more things like interviews with Sasha, I definitely recommend you become a supporter, because it gives you all kinds of great benefits like this episode without any of the advertisements or any of the interruptions. But there's so much more to being a supporter of The Politics Guys. It includes things like being a part of our very active Discord group, and all kinds of other benefits. So if you want to support great interviews like this on The Lie Detectives, I recommend you head to patreon.com/politicsguys right now. Take a look at all the different levels of support and the different options you'll have to support the show, support the mission, and support the guys behind the podcast. So again, head to patreon.com/politicsguys, because shows like this are only possible with your support. If you'd like to support us in other ways, we're on Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal. All of those support links are in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. If you want to buy the book, you'll also find links to that for The Lie Detectives in those show notes as well. If you'd like to be any kind of our member and you just can't support us right now, we totally get that. But we would love for you to be able to share, subscribe, rate, and review this episode in whichever podcast app you use on social media. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or anything else you'd like to ask us about the book, this interview, or anything else we do at the Politics Guys, please give us a line at mail@politicsguys.com. You can also reach us on Facebook and X. You'll find all of those links, you guessed it, in the show notes. As always, I want to give a warm thank you to the executive producers of the Politics Guys, who are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Marino, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a full-length episode this weekend. I hope you'll join us then.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.